me. Ooh-wee, it's me. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit. So y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along. Ow. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit. So y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along.
Ow. Yeah, what's poppin', y'all? Welcome to another installment of the Nestorius Public Radio. I'm Nestor Rodriguez. I'm your motherfucking host. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it's Thursday night. You haven't washed your underwear. You don't have any rice milk left in your refrigerator. You ain't got no unlimited calling, but you got internet. That's why you're listening. That's why you're listening live.
Yeah.
All right. All right. All right. Yeah, tonight we got a very, very interesting and exciting and high energy show. We're gonna be discussing one of my favorite topics, New York City, and we have an authority. We actually have a couple of authorities. I want you to, first of all, I want to introduce one of my guests. This guy, what aren't you? You know, this is. Let me first say by your name, Florent Morellet.
You did.
I did good. Morellet. He's French. I'm learning my French. Hello?
I'm American, actually.
You're American now?
Yes.
He's like, I love him. I'm like, he's like, fuck that. I'm American. I love it. Florent Morellet. This guy is a world-renowned restaurateur on the New York City's Meatpacking District. He's a political activist. He's fucking had everybody and anybody in his restaurant.
I'm actually more a community activist.
Community. Okay, yeah. Not a political activist. Well, community.
You have to be, be political to get anything.
But more specific, you've been involved in your community in Greenwich, in the Village, and the Meatpacking District, and gay, lesbian, transgendered, bisexual.
Meatpacking. Meatpacking.
Oh, it's not Meatpacking?
Meat Market.
I just want to say, that's Rosemary Rodriguez. I just want to say something. When I was growing up in New York, that was called the Meatpacking District, okay? There were limos going there. Transsexuals were getting out and getting into other people's cars. It was Meatpacking, okay?
Or Meat Market, you know, I call it the Meat Market, you know, where in the middle of the night you could buy, you know, you could purchase
meat.
Dead meat and live meat.
Live meat.
Yes.
Big up to all your live meat eating motherfuckers. Yeah. All right. So, but community activist. That's a good distinction. So you're very involved in that stuff. But everybody and anybody was in your restaurant between 1985 and 2008 when it closed. I mean, who wasn't in your restaurant? I saw a picture of Amy Winehouse, fucking trying to read a menu in your restaurant. Who wasn't in your restaurant? You were just telling me about Julian Schnabel was in your restaurant.
You know, I think the Bushes were not in my restaurant.
They weren't allowed. They weren't allowed.
No. The chair of the Republican Party was one of my regular customers.
Right, you know, right.
Before.
The chair
and
or
after
the chairman?
He went to jail. You know?
Hold on, let me continue with the introductions. Rosemary Rodriguez is to your right, a director, producer, book rights holder, co-creator, producer. You just sold but you're working on a pilot for the Sundance Channel based on the gentleman and his restaurant that is to your left, Mr. Florent Morellet.
That's correct.
All right. And his dealings and wheelings and all that other stuff. And then to your right, we have Tamara Warren. Tamara, is that? Tamara.
Tamara.
What the fuck is up with you white motherfuckers? Can't it just be Tamara? One way to say, fucking say it. It used to be back in the day, your name was Joe, not Joa. It's
actually,
fucking
Tamara,
Joe.
Tamara is the correct. I mean,
Tamara.
That's
yeah. The is that the route? So it's us Puerto Ricans that are fucked up.
I mean, that's how we do it in Detroit.
So. Oh, shit. So now she came up with her fucking, like, East Side Detroit voice. Like, that's how we do it in Detroit.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So, Tamara Warren is a writer,
Yes.
She's been published in Delta, Sky Miles magazine, to fucking, Details, New York Times. I know you don't want to.
Forbes.
You don't want to. I have to get the smaller parts out of the way first to get to the big ones. Forbes, you were in some hip-hop magazines. Give me a name. We got some hip-hop heads here.
Vibe. Double XL.
Whoop, whoop. Vibe, yeah,
Dub
Vibe
magazine.
But here's the most important thing. Here's the most important thing. So you are one of four. You were telling me this the other night.
Right.
You're one of four women in the on the jury, right? Four women or three women?
Oh, three.
Three.
I believe.
Okay, I'm always adding one. So you're one of three women on the board of the world's best car.
World Car of the Year.
World's best car. Same shit. World Car of the Year. Fucking around, baby. Rosemary's like, come on, dude. What the hell? But you know, look, the car of the year, the World Car of the Year.
Yes.
Committee.
Yes.
And explain that to us.
We drive cars, we vote, and then we decide the World Car of the Year.
No. You don't. I vote, so what does that entail? I mean, what is the credibility of the World Car of the Year organization or whatever?
Well, it definitely has its more in-depth analysis as far as, you know, just it's not just get in the car and
right.
drive and go. We go through a whole set of criteria,
uh-huh.
trying to decide, you know, what fuel economy, technology.
Got it.
Design, and then we break it down into categories. So there's performance car of the year, mm-hmm. green car of the year.
What does the winner get of the best of the world car of the year? Anything?
Well, they get a nice trophy.
And the recognition.
And probably some more sales.
Got it.
And
got
then
it.
They can put it in their commercials.
Right.
And you go say, and world car of the year.
Got it.
North American
got it.
Car of the
got
year.
It.
So,
got it.
Like that.
And you're in LA test driving a few cars, a few or just one? Because I was in that Mercedes-Benz you were rocking.
Yeah, well, I drove a Mercedes-Benz S-Class coupe. Which I'll be driving. That I'm driving the 2014 model, and I'll be driving the 2015 model in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But today I drove the Jaguar F-Type Coupe.
Right.
So or coupe, as mm-hmm. they like to
coupe.
Say, the Brits do, right. And had a.
They
great,
say coupe.
Yeah, it's actually. Well, we ask,
you know what
ask
Americans
our,
say.
Our French.
You know what Americans say about bald British? Toupe. That's what we say. All right, the coupe.
Yes, and it's fantastic. I drove three different models, three different engines. The
nice.
Best one being the R-Type, and I drove it on the track at Willow Springs today.
Right. I was trying to ask you where the hell Willow Springs is. I'm going to Google it while right in the middle of our, when we start the debate about all sorts of stuff and the discussion about New York. So you're a transplant. You live in New York now. How long have you been in New York? 10 years? 11 years. And Rosemary, you are originally from, born in Boston, originally from New Hampshire. And
I've been in New York 31 years.
You've been in New York 31 years. When did you come to New York? What
1983.
Year? 1983. Great year to come to New York, by the way. And Florent, you've been in New York how many years?
36 years.
36 years.
78.
And the United States in general as a whole, did you come to New York first?
Yep, that okay. time, yeah.
78. Very interesting year, 78.
First time I came to the U.S., first trip was in 67.
Okay, all right. And so... let me ask you this. What made you become an American? Like, what made you say, I want to become an American citizen?
Well, you know, it was obvious the first time my parents took us on a road trip across America when I was just turned 14 in 1967. And I went like, oh, my God, you know, I'm not abnormal. I was just born American in bumfuck France.
So you were born American. In the wrong body.
No.
In the wrong country.
Yes. And especially, you know, in bumfuck France.
Yes.
I could have been born American in Paris. It would have been a little easier, maybe. But I was just in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
You know, a great family.
I mean, mm-hmm.
you
know, 67, when you first came to the United States, how old were you about?
14.
14.
Yeah.
14.
And I went like, oh, wow, you know, I'm not the ugly, you know, the ugly duckling.
Uh-huh. So when you came back to, and you decided to be in New York in 78, you were about 20?
No, I made sure that summer that I would go back the next one. So I got myself invited.
Okay.
By a family who stayed with an Anglo family in Montreal, but I came back and came back and came back.
Okay.
And I lived a year in San Francisco, 73, 74.
Mm-hmm.
And I came a lot to LA because I had a boyfriend in Silver Lake.
In Silver Lake?
Where I'm staying now. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, that's good. So one of the things, I mean, I'm one of those New Yorkers, and I was looking into your restaurant, and after looking at the pictures, remember we had a conversation the other day in Malibu, beautiful Malibu, about, I wasn't sure if I had ever been into your restaurant, and I definitely had never been into your restaurant, which is ridiculous. You know what I mean? Because I am a native New Yorker.
Yes, it's ridiculous. It's a blotch on your CV, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's weird because I'll say things like, oh, yeah, Rosemary's working on this project, Florent, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, I know Florent. Fucking people that are like out of nowhere. And I'm like, well, how come I didn't, you know what I mean? How come I didn't know? It's weird.
But because it was up in 24 hours, some people eventually realized they were so fucked up, they were there but at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but I was fucked up many times, Florent.
Maybe suddenly at one point you're going to go like, oh, my God, you know, the memory is going to reappear.
Right.
Because it was a diner.
I know what it was. I mean, believe me, I saw the documentary. So what I want to say is, for those of you that want to know about this, follow it up. There's a documentary on Florent. What is it called? Queen?
It's called Florent, Queen of the Meat Market.
Queen of the Meat Market. Yeah, very good documentary. It captures.
And it says queen because, you know, for the high holidays, we used to do drag.
Right.
Not that I like to do drag, but it was part of my job.
Bastille Day?
And Florent will be Marie Antoinette. Right? Yes. Looking quite gorgeous, I must say.
Which I'm going to say this. Before we go, like, the show unravels and evolves, I just want to say this. Florent is... of like, probably, I don't know him that long and that well, but probably one of the most... well-informed and intelligent and educated socio-political people and up to now that I know.
Thank you.
Just by talking to you. You're also an artist. You're fascinated by maps.
I'm a map artist.
You're a map artist, so you do works based on maps. I don't know how to describe it. I've seen some of your work. Very interesting, very beautiful. But you're also, your background is urban planning, which makes it even more interesting.
The maps, yeah. I studied urban planning because I was making maps of cities since I'm a young teenager.
Uh-huh.
But because my father is an artist, you know, those doodles of maps, you know, my parents told me I was an artist, which for me was, you know, really a drawback. It was like, oh, no, please don't tell me I'm an artist, you know. And my mother was saying, oh, do them neat and keep them. And it was just like, oh, please, no. And I've been an artist kind of against my own will. But I've exhibited and done it through the years, especially when I'm pretty depressed and nothing going on in my life. I'm more of an artist. It's very interesting, but it's manic obsessive, compulsive.
Yeah, but I mean, art, painting, drawing, all that type of stuff is meditative in a way. It's a way to connect with yourself and kind of let your spirit flow. I mean, I paint also, and it's a solo sport. It's not like you have to worry about somebody criticizing you or telling you, no, don't put that line there. You know what I mean?
Except in my case, you know, my parents will be going, have you drawn lately?
Now. You're saying...
Well, I'm not talking to them anymore.
No. A lot of us aren't talking to our parents.
Yes, still.
But your father is a famous artist.
My father
is. Tell us about your father.
My father is probably the most famous living French artist.
Rembrandt?
What? What did you say? I didn't hear.
No, I said Rembrandt. I'm fucking with you.
No, but
your
living,
father's probably
living.
No, I know.
A minimalist artist.
One of the most famous living, probably the most famous
living artist.
French artist.
Yes,
right,
and
now.
He's, you know, he's 88.
Who is he? Tell me his name.
His name is François Morellet. So
François
Morellet. Yeah, and you know, there's a work in at LACMA. The MoMA just acquired and is showing, you know, one of his major pieces.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, no, he's major shit, which makes it even, you know, more daunting.
Tomorrow, tell me the name of that racetrack again.
Willow Springs.
Willow Springs.
Okay, I'm gonna do a little multitasking here. Willow Springs Raceway. Okay. There's also Willow Springs Apartments. Anyway, so this is weird. I just Googled it.
So the reason we're here today,
North
is, I think.
Yes, go ahead.
Because we were having a conversation last night.
Yes.
Or we a couple days ago at dinner, we took a ride to Malibu.
We have this conversation all the time.
All the time about New York. We still have an apartment there. For many years, we've had an apartment there. I spend half my time there.
1991, I've had that apartment.
Okay, and so between Nestor and I, we always have this debate about New York. He hates New York, doesn't want to be there. I still love New York. I don't want to lose ties there. And
Tamara.
Tamara lives with, you know, her.
Tamara.
Tamara. Who's,
you know what?
Terrible.
Can I just
that's
say something?
So bad.
Can I just
so
say
hard.
Something? This has happened to me every time. The last time I had a friend of mine, I kept calling him Jamal, and his name was Jamel. Remember?
It's Tamara.
Tamara. Okay. So fucking sorry about that.
So there's a we talk about nostalgia, and one of the things that's fascinating about Florent is his view of the past, and being that he created this restaurant and saw in basically what was a shithole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. By anyone's standards.
The Meatpacking District, for those that don't know, let
drugs,
me just describe it.
Crack.
The Meatpacking District is a really nasty, gritty...
Was.
Dark. There, in other words, there's no reason, absolutely no reason for anybody to be there after a certain time, except during the day when... You know, the meatpacking industry, which is, it was primarily a meatpacking industry where they slaughterhouses, butchers.
No, actually, they were not slaughtering. They were meatpacking.
Oh, they were just slaughtering there?
There never were slaughtering there.
Oh, okay, I thought they slaughtered.
They were just cutting.
They had the carcasses, cutting them up and packaging them. Got
it. Yes. And in 85, when I opened, there was a couple of thousand people still working in the industry, and they were starting working around 1, 2 a.m., and they were closing between 11 and 12 a.m., mm-hmm. 11 and 12 p.m.
Uh-huh.
And the only,
it was an early business.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the trucks would come from Nebraska.
And it smells there. I mean, it's just nasty. It used to, I mean, not now, but it used to smell.
Yes, of course, because, you know, New York City's, you know, was broke at the time, and the cleaning and all that shit was not happening.
The borderline thing that there was the old Homestead restaurant, which was on 9th Avenue.
And Frank's on 14th Street.
And Frank's, yes.
And a couple of diners, and I took over one of the diners, which was opening at midnight and closing at noon. And the other businesses going on were really the dirty, brown-sheared gay bars.
Okay.
Like the Mineshaft, the Anvil that I used to frequent because I'm a raunchy gay man.
Hold on a second. We got to give you a big up on that. Big up, you raunchy, big old nasty man, yeah.
And the other trade going on in the neighborhood, from a long time before I moved to New York, has been transgender prostitution.
Right.
Which we called the trannies.
Yes.
And
that was my first, when I remember the first time I saw that part of town as being weird, I swear, I think I was like 17. There were a couple of after hours not far from there.
Yeah.
And I believe we went to eat at one of those fucking diners or whatever. It could have been before you had opened up.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so I remember seeing very affluent white men, right, in suit and ties, coming in a limo or a town car, parking underneath one of those overpasses where the fucking meat packing establishments were, and there were the streets were jam packed with when I say jam packed, there were a lot of tranny hookers.
Well, that
there
was the only people walking.
Right, the only people walking. Correct, and one of them or two of them would get in the car, and I'm like, holy shit, I never seen anything like this. You know what I mean? And bam, there we go.
And so even Hasid.
Yes. And they have wives and all this other shit, and they go in there, no one knows.
It's a highly unlikely neighborhood to sort of go in there and see a place to open a restaurant
right.
that ends up becoming a mecca and a, yes. and a highlight of New York City life at that time.
Right.
Because the thing that made it special, well, to me, because the first time I went there, my friend Sharn, like, there was a couple of us going there.
To smoke crack in the bathroom.
Well, I was down and dirty. No. I was raunchy like
to
Veron,
smoke,
and
to even smoke crack. I was like, raunchy and I was a raunchy
and
fucking...
I was like, what the hell are we going this way for?
Right.
Like, what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden, we were at this restaurant, and it was like all these people in there. The French fries were great, but
That's what I heard, the French fries.
I love the French fries. But what made it special was that it was very welcoming to anyone in New York. Mm-hmm. At a time when, you know, other clubs where you had to wait in line or had velvet ropes, this was like open 24/7. Depending on what time of day, there'd be a different group of people.
But why wouldn't it be? I mean, restaurants didn't have velvet ropes and didn't
because there was a lot of people.
Because of the neighborhood, it worked as a velvet rope.
Mm-hmm.
Many people and friends told me, oh, we were walking down or driving down, but mostly walking down. And their friends, who were more square than they were, said, we're not going any further. And many times there was situation where people would not go
right.
because they were too square for the place.
Right.
And that was how the neighborhood worked as a velvet rope. And my intention was from the get-go that there will be value, mm-hmm. that the food was not going to be fucking pretentious. Like, it was going to be a diner that would be French diner. And
what made it a French diner?
At 2 o'clock in the morning, it was mostly like an American menu. But
burgers,
you would get
omelets.
Yeah, but you would get mussels.
Okay.
And you would get eggs and a blood sausage.
Oh, fuck. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Blood sausage.
And you would get,
hold on a second.
You could get a pate.
Hold the fuck up. Those of you that don't know what blood sausage is, hold on a second. Puerto Ricans called it morcilla. Morcilla. How do you say it in France?
Boudin noir.
Boudin noir. Black pudding.
Black pudding, yes.
Black pudding. Big up for boudin noir. Morcilla, motherfuckers. Fucking blood sausage. No, seriously, a lot of people will never eat that. They just, it looks disgusting.
But we have the best in New York.
Could I tell you something? That is one of the most amazing delicacies. If you've never had it, try it. It's amazing. So tell me, how do you prepare that? I'm just curious.
We bought it from somebody that
you
made it.
You bought it already made?
Yes, from the best.
Got it. As
but
a kid.
The French fries made it from fresh potatoes.
Fresh potatoes, like In-N-Out Burger here in L.A. You ever been to In-N-Out?
No.
I'm going to take it in and out. People hate the fucking fries at In-N-Out here because they're fresh. They like that processed bullshit.
No, but they're not crispy.
You can get them crispy.
It's hard work.
It's hard work.
From fresh potatoes to make them fucking crispy, took us a long time. But we got
it. The oil has to be extremely hot all the time.
But you have to pre-fry them and then refrigerate them. And then the second fry at the end, they come out cold.
Got it.
So eventually, we're serving more than 3,000 people a week.
You're right. They come out cold. That's the thing with In-N-Out that a lot of people don't like.
Eventually, when we're serving the most was burgers and fries for French place, fabulous.
Got it.
We always had somebody working on fucking potatoes, either peeling them, washing them.
Hey, fucking potato guy! We need more fucking potatoes being cut, you fuck!
You should have seen on Friday the mountains of potatoes coming.
I can imagine. But okay, so the documentary starts from the place where you have the diner, the restaurant, and you just wanted it to be a low-key type of thing. And then a writer reviews it and says it's the best thing, yada, yada, yada. It blows up. Everybody wants to go to your restaurant. And you weren't pleased about that. That's not what you were expecting.
Well, because I'd worked in another restaurant in New York before, and someone who totally fucked up by... talking too much to the media before opening, and we were not ready, and it was a total disaster.
Got it.
And I wanted a slow, mellow growth.
Got it. So that's what it was. It was that you wanted the restaurant to evolve at its own pace,
We could, we were sitting 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know what you're doing.
Sure. Especially a 24-hour diner.
The first week, you want, the first days, you want to serve 20, then 30, then 40.
Yeah, yeah. It's a relatively big place, yeah.
How did you find the location?
A friend of mine lived just next door, and she was actually one of the two women selling meat. And she was, but she was a photographer, too. Mm-hmm. She's in the movie. And
yes.
And then she said one day, I talked to the Greek next door, and he owned the building, but he wanted to sell the business. And I said, oh, fuck, this is the greatest place. And I knew the neighborhood, and I loved the neighborhood at night. And because of the place, it was obvious that it should be open 24 hours.
Mm. What did you notice about it when you first walked in? What was the first thing?
I had been there before. So I had,
as the diner, it was already a diner before.
Coming
that.
Out of the dirty, raunchy gay bars, I'd been there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right, because where else can you get a burger and have some fries after a dirty, raunchy hangout?
And from the outside, it was so much like the painting Nighthawk Edward Hopper. Yeah. One of my most favorite paintings. I just love the place. So when she told me it was available, and for me the neighborhood was great. The rent, the place was existing. I didn't need a designer. It was so affordable and close to everything.
Mm-hmm.
A block from the village, mm-hmm. Two mm-hmm. blocks from the subway.
The subway, yeah.
But it was like a no man's land. People didn't know it existed. Mm-hmm. A terra incognita.
Mm-hmm.
And it was magical. But it gotten really tough in the late 80s, around 1990, with the crack epidemic.
Crack.
But crack, in 1985, when I opened, crack just appeared. It was just...
You can thank a Channel 7 Eyewitness News, because they were the first ones to say, there's an epidemic of crack cocaine on the Upper East Side of New York City.
But that was later.
People are taking cocaine, cooking it with acetone, and it's popping like wildfire. Back to you, News at 11.
Uh-huh.
And no one knew about fucking crack until the news media put it out there. Then everyone's like, fuck, crack? Let me try that shit. That's what happened. Motherfuckers got hooked. You know what I mean?
It's the egg and the chicken.
Okay. So let's go into a little segue here. Let's segue into our thing. So in 1990, this was when you mentioned the year. 1990, by the way, was a very transformative time in my life. That's when I stopped drinking and getting high. That was it for me. That's when I hit my bottom in September. So crack, I remember crack like hitting the street, like you said, in the late 80s, 87, 88, 89. 87, it started coming around, 88, 89, bam, it was crazy. So let me start throwing out some statistics. So in 1990, during the Dinkins' tenure, an astonishing 2,245 murders were committed in New York City, compared to 332 last year. Okay, so let's start with that, because I guess the crux of our show, I was hoping that it would instigate some sort of conversation and dialogue about this thing that New Yorkers, past, present, and future, have always going on. New York fucking sucks now. Uh-huh. I like New York better when you can get a fucking hooker on Times Square. I'm tired of this fucking Disneyland bullshit. I like going to Times Square when you can go in there to the peep shows, then go and check out three fucking kung fu double feature movies, and then, get high and maybe get stabbed. That's what made it really exciting, right? So that's the dialogue. And then there are people like you who
I love Times Square now.
Well, you're a very interesting guy.
I think was what when I met Florent, one of the things that struck me within like an hour when we were talking
mm-hmm.
was his perspective on the fact that he started this restaurant. This restaurant was basically priced out of this neighborhood that became the hottest neighborhood in Manhattan.
Oh my God.
It still is.
Oh my God. Yeah, for those
that don't. The fact that he didn't look at it with any amount of bitterness or anger or nostalgia
makes him interesting.
And in fact, was like, no, change is good. It's good that this is happening.
So
gentrification
paint the picture. So from that description of the meatpacking district that we talked about a little while ago to now, it's like Apple Store, Standard Hotel. You got like shishi restaurant at the some of the most beautiful people are there at 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 in the morning. It's the complete opposite. So
somebody said to me, so what you see in the meat market, there was somebody interviewing me that had interviewed me before from Europe, you know, expecting a negative answer. So what do you see? What I see there is thousands of jobs that did not exist before. I don't have to love or even like the meatpacking district now. There are so many neighborhoods that I couldn't go to before in New York City, which is actually where I moved to, like Bushwick.
Right, you couldn't go
5 years
before.
Ago, Bushwick was too dangerous.
Right.
I love Brooklyn.
Right.
I can live in Bushwick now. Bushwick is a gigantic meatpacking district, like it was 25, 30 years ago.
It's unfound territory.
Yes, I can ride my bicycle for hours.
Right.
You know, it is fantastic. We had 55 million tourists in New York last year. This is an industry that barely existed when I moved to New York
in the
70s.
Yeah.
We had a complete collapse of our smoke tax industry. We lost a third of the economy. Okay, tourism doesn't get the jobs that used to pay like blue collars, but still, it is, you know, the industry that, you know, we have the most jobs in the city. And these are jobs, you know, for Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, there's a cost to it. It's not that pleasant to live in Manhattan. And actually, you know.
Stop. What do you mean by that?
Manhattan has become the central business district. New York used to be a city on an island.
Hold on. I'm smelling some nostalgia. Hold on a second.
New York.
I'm smelling some nostalgia. New York used to be.
No, continue.
Now,
New York is a city with a river in the middle.
Can I tell you something?
Listen to me.
Nobody can ever live in New York City without saying New York used to be.
No one
in New York can ever do that.
It's growing.
I agree with you, by the way.
It used to be a city on an island. Now it's a city with a river in the middle with two banks.
Got it.
You know, on the West Bank is the island of Manhattan.
Right.
On the East Bank is Queens and Brooklyn.
Right.
And actually, the critical mass of what makes, you know, the creativity, the core of the city has shifted to the East Bank of the East River.
Yeah.
You know, and now we can see New York, you know, like Paris, the East Bank, the Left Bank, the Right Bank, London, the South Bank, the North Bank. New York now is a city with a river in the middle. Not a city.
Big up for all you motherfucker that used to say New York used to be. New York used to be less smelly than your feet, man. New York used to be. You get stabbed in the neck, man. New York used to be. ..
Yeah. It's not nostalgia. It's just.
Listen, I'm going to tell you something.
It's growing.
I'm going to read a quote from the Daily Beast, and this was January 6, 2014. A very good article that you emailed me, with the title "Weren't Those the Bad Old Days? The Poison of New York City Nostalgia." So there's a part that says, not everyone is nostalgic, though. New Yorkers of a certain vintage will recall Florent, the infamous all-night meatpacking district diner and regular haunt of vapid models and coked-out downtown club kids. Like almost every neighborhood in Manhattan, the meatpacking district has since transformed haute couture and expensive restaurants, and Florent, owned by the eminently quotable French restaurateur Florent Morellet, was an inevitable casualty of the transformation. When Florent closed, Spike Lee provided a typical quote to the New York Times, "I've been going to Florent since 1986 whenever I can. but the whole neighborhood changed. Before, it used to be transvesticles and trans testicles on every corner. Now, forget about it. Anyway, so that's Spike Lee. But you, you're like, fuck it. I'm glad. Now, let me ask you a question. Is that possibly because you had enough of that era and you were ready to move on?
Yes, 23 fucking years so you're doing
actually,
this.
So you're actually happy that you were priced out. You're like, fuck it, good, I'm
everybody,
out.
Everybody, you know, everybody and their mothers wanted me to keep on doing the right. same shit until I dropped dead in the middle of the of fucking floor.
Of course, because they don't have to do it. They don't have to do it. They just show up at your restaurant whenever they feel like it.
They wanted to propose legislation at the city level to make the inside, because the neighborhood is landmark, and I've been responsible for that. But they wanted to landmark the inside so that I would keep on going and going and
tell
going.
Tell me how you became instrumental in making the Meatpacking District a landmark. Status. What you're involved. You said you were like we said earlier. Yes. You're a community activist, and you're involved in the local politics. And
you know, I'm a maverick, a real one, not like that senator from Arizona. Mm-hmm, because I was involved with a co-chair in an organization called Save Ganzevoort Market, and in 3 years...
Save Ganzevoort Market. That's where your restaurant was on Ganzevoort Street, and there was a market there as well.
When I realized that, you know, I mean, it's amazing because of the economics of the meat market, and three major landowners own most of the buildings, that the neighborhood was intact, really intact. And you can film... 30s, 40s movie, and it still is, of course, because of the historic district.
Well, it's also very iron and concrete looking, like very solidly built, the whole neighborhood.
You have some, you know, really important industrial architecture of mid, late 19th century. and then it was turned, there was a decision to make it into a meat market in the 40s, and it's very interesting. And you have some brilliant architecture. The Greenwich Village for historical preservation, I say.
That's a historical preservation.
Oh, sorry,
for you guys.
My French. put me with a co-chair, and in 3 years, but because of the star power that was coming to my restaurant, immediately, you know, Diane von Furstenberg was like, oh, you know, I will host.
That's Diane von Furstenberg, for all you guys that don't speak French. Go ahead.
And Calvin Klein was like, oh, you know, I'll be on the committee. So we were able to raise money and visibility
You use that power... All that star power and all your connections there to say we need to preserve.
But
this
it was
the way
very
it is.
Easy. They were coming to the restaurants, you know, and like Calvin would say, "Oh, what's new?" And I would say, "Oh, I'm doing an event for."
I will say this. One of the things that you cannot say about New York is that New York and New Yorkers don't give a fuck about their buildings and their areas. You can't say that we New Yorkers don't care.
So you know, it's good to preserve some.
Yes,
but. At the moment, you know, my generation is into making New York into Paris. I mean, Manhattan especially, but some part of
making
Brooklyn.
Making Manhattan into what?
Paris.
Uh-huh.
France.
Yeah.
You know, not the other one.
Yes.
And it's
But
it's
I got to say that one of the we're in Los Angeles right now, and I love Los Angeles. I love, like you, you love change. You love that you're somewhere else. I love change in this phase of my life. I love peace and quiet. I love that we have a house. I love, you know, I don't love going back to New York and getting on a train and having to deal with 50 smelly motherfuckers. You know what I don't like about New York?
I like to smell young men.
Yeah.
Hello.
I think the crux of what we're talking about
is
being
able, call in a minute.
Being able to embrace change or not.
To and balance the two.
The kind of person that wants to embrace change or not. And when you look at nostalgia or people are nostalgic, it's like a bittersweet, like fond longing for the past. And I think you can only really be nostalgic because there's something wrong with what's right now.
Or
and you
want
to
hold on to the past without, as opposed to, in, like you said, embrace the present and go with the flow of what's going on
right
now.
Well, I think it was, you know, it's very interesting to think about the 70s. I always romanticized New York in the 70s just because I know that year that we were looking at the statistics, uh-huh. that amount of murders, it's across the board.
Yeah.
The statistics are appalling of the amount of crime going on.
But
the fact that it's 1990 was the height of it.
Yeah.
From
1960 to 2012.
Hold on. I was homeless in 1990. And I looked at those statistics today, all this crime that's happening, and I was like, this is the height of the worst in New York. And I was out there thinking I was like a badass. Just a really sick person running around with nowhere to go. And I'm lucky to be alive. But the fact is, that's what I romanticize.
It was like awful.
But there's a part of me that felt proud. I had so much pride. I was so sick. I had so much pride that I felt like I could survive.
But you were young, too. When you're young, the future is in front of you. So the nostalgia, the memories of that time is tainted by that, because you know we were young, and of course, I realized that nostalgia was nasty when I was young, and in bumfuck France where I grew up, all the older men, the best time of their lives was when they did their military service, which was compulsory, and that was the only that they were young. And that's the only time they went away from bumfuck France.
Right.
And you hear
nostalgia is a French word anyway, right? And you hate it. Isn't nostalgia a French word?
It's probably coming from Latin.
The root of it started when like people going to the army and like being homesick.
Oh, it comes from the army?
Yes. So what he's saying.
My example is good,
Yes, but it is. I mean, I was looking at the definition today, which I can't pull up.
But
right
is it not a French word, though? Am I wrong?
No, it's not a French
word. Okay.
It's coming from...
It has roots in Latin.
Latin.
Homesickness. Yes. Homesickness. And it the first time it was in use regarding army. Yes. But then going off to the army and wanting to be nostalgic to be home.
Okay, but in the case I'm describing is... Yes. You know, in France, you have to do your military service. It's delayed if you go to study, but all of the in the countryside, in where I grew up, the old men they were 18 or 20, and they at that time it was a year and a half or 2 years, and they were young. The future was in front of them. They were not yet married, and. You hear them, and it was the best time of their life. It was military service.
I think it has to do something with risk, because I think when you're young is when you have a greater propensity to take more risks in your life. And so as you get older, risks become scarier and harder and not as attractive, and your adrenaline doesn't pump the same way. It was when you're young, and so danger is a risk.
Danger, 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 Will Robinson, danger.
But it's so interesting fearless. To think about like New York. If New York stayed the way it was in the 70s and 80s, it could end up like Detroit, which is where you're from.
It would have ended up like Detroit.
Leaving. Like it's absurd to think of New York today and being nostalgic for those times when it could have ended up like Detroit.
Let me give you some statistics.
I kind of see it both ways. And what you're saying, maybe that's a good way to get into the statistics. But I mean... I've been in New York for a decade, but I still feel like an outsider because I wasn't part of that era. And so my impressions from that era is the way everyone romanticizes New York City. And it's about opportunity and dreams. And so while I think that change is part of our lives and necessary and just a fact of life, and sometimes I think in the United States especially, we're a little disconnected from that because it's just so natural to us, and we're such a young nation when you look at the grand scheme of things. But I also think that there's always been multiple boroughs in New York City, and I think there's the New York that's fast and fun and fresh and all about the scene, but there's also always been the great subcultures of New York City. And I think the deeper you dig in New York City, you can And I learned this maybe growing up in a place like Detroit where it looks nasty on the outside and everybody thinks there's nothing there. And we are like, great. Then you'll never know what's going on behind a closed door. Right. And I think that Manhattan used to have that. And it's probably always been in all parts of the city and the depths of, you know, you go into places and you find amazing artists and you have, you know, subcultures, multicultures, people from all over the world.
This is why it was time for me to move out of Manhattan. You know, Manhattan is like Hong Kong Island. It's where we get the taxes.
Hong Kong Island? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Hong
Kong? Yeah, but, you know, instead of Tsim Sha Tsui, you know, the peninsula, this is where we get the taxes. It Brooklyn, you know, Bushwick for me is so much... Like, it, you know, it was, but much safer. And like Detroit is. I have some friends in the music who are from Detroit. And I completely agree with you. But too many people think of New York as being Manhattan.
Right.
But it's not really.
It's the five boroughs. It's always been the five boroughs, but it's always been separated by, Staten Island, that's Italian, Brooklyn.
Well, Staten Island is...
But I'm just saying, that's the ignorant view.
A bit further, but yeah.
But Staten Island's got some amazing jewels if you go there.
You haven't met Denise yet. You've met Denise? Denise lives in Staten Island. I mean, there's...
Oh, yeah.
There's an old part.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's true. There's, like Tamara said, a cultural, subcultural pockets everywhere. That the same thing in LA. People will say, LA sucks. There's no culture. That's because you're fucking sleeping in the backyard. You need to go out and you need to explore. There's Vietnamese culture. There's Mexican culture. There's Cuban culture. There's all sorts of culture. You just got to go and look for it.
And
you know?
There's the subway.
There's the subway here in New York.
But
you're taking the Red Line Metro. You'd be a perfect spokesperson for Go Metro LA. Seriously, you would be.
I took a place 5 minutes walking from the subway. Therefore, I can come to you guys.
Yeah, it's awesome. Let me just say that what's interesting to me as the only native New Yorker, and we have a call. I know. Is the caller still there? Yeah? Who's that? Come on.
Yo,
what's poppin',
G? This is Big Kev from New Rochelle. I just want to say I love the show and what you guys are talking about. And big up to NPR and the Story is Public Radio and Rosemary Rodriguez and all you motherfuckers. I'm riding the D-train downtown with a homosexual prostitute. I'm with a tranny prostitute right now. We're going to get some French fries listening to the show. And I just want to say big up to Detroit.
Big up, Troy. Big up to Detroit.
Big up to Detroit.
Yo, have you tried one of those tranny hookers from downtown New Rochelle?
Oh, yeah. You know, we're just going to get some French fries and dip it in the ketchup.
Yo, they're buttery, yo. They're buttery.
Shout out to Tamara.
Tamara, we just fucked up her name like 100 times. I'm going to do a show. How many ways can you fuck up Tamara's name? I'm like, Tamara. I'm going to do a show next time you're in town.
Don't take it personal, girl. Nessa was fucked up from the get. Check it.
Yo, check it.
You guys are doing.
Hey, yo.
Je t'aime beaucoup.
Thank you. Hey, I spent a lot of time in New Rochelle years ago. I had a boyfriend from there. It's a cool place.
Maybe it's him. Maybe it's this motherfucker
No.
Hey, yo, thanks for calling in, man. Big love. Big up to New Rochelle.
Thank
you know what I'm saying? Big up to bubblegum hookers and all that shit.
All right.
Peace. So what I was going to say, this guy's been on hold. I apologize for having him on hold for all this time. Let's just get into it. But as the only native New Yorker in there, I got to tell you that I guess part of it, especially as a minority, as a Puerto Rican, growing up in New York City, there was a clear-cut defining socioeconomic line. For instance, I grew up on 92nd Street between 2nd and 3rd. That's Yorkville. That's a predominantly German-Irish neighborhood. If you're a Latino or you're black, you're going to stick out like a sore thumb. And we did, even though it was all working class, right? And that's 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Lexington Avenue, 3rd Avenue was commercial. You go over to Park Avenue, Madison Avenue, 5th Avenue. That's when you can really see that you're fucking welfare material. You know what I mean? That's when you can see, wow, that's how these motherfuckers are living. So there was always this us against them mentality that we all have, and New Yorkers have that. Like Brooklyn, for instance, if you're Italian, you have Bay Ridge, you have certain areas that are predominantly Italian. If you're black, what the fuck are you doing there? You know what I mean? So what happens with, and we're not going to talk about nostalgia, but what happens with gentrification, what happens is that now you really can't clear-cut define all that stuff. Now you got white people coming up on up in East Harlem, acting like they're going to rob you. You know what I mean? When I was a kid, I know I'm going all over the place, there's something to be said about having to be alert all the time, right? And now this is just a nostalgic perspective, not an educated or an intelligent perspective. It's just a nostalgic perspective. It's kind of like, you know, when I was a kid, you had to be on your toes. You had to fucking walk around and see who's this guy, what's that guy. You got to size everybody up. Now you can walk around with your fucking head up your ass texting and nothing happens. 20 years ago, you did that shit, you'd be fucking... Forget stuck up. They just take your shit. They take your baby. They take your hoe. They take your fucking bank account. It'd be like in one swipe. You know what I mean?
Well, I ended up in the emergency room.
I know.
Okay.
And I was going to fucking...
It still happens.
You know, no.
It depends on the neighbors where you go.
Florent, tell us what happened to you because you're going to get schooled right now. What happened to you? Some fuck in Bushwick took your fucking iPhone.
Another fuck took my iPhone. Another iPhone 6 months before in the Lower East Side.
And what are you doing?
You know those smartphones are making us dumb.
Yes, we know this already. That's another show.
Because we get absorbed by it.
Yeah,
but
what happened to you? You fucking chased the guy.
Both cases,
I chased the guy. The
second time, you know, I told him, "Hey, motherfucker, give me my phone back." I was too close to him, and he hit me so bad that I fell and crushed my face.
Sure, sure. Why'd you do that, man? Why'd you say, "Hey, motherfucker, give me your phone"? Why?
Give me my phone back.
Yeah, why?
Because I was upset because the first one got away with it.
Yeah, but don't you know that fucking iPhone has a satellite? He can take the phone, shove it up his ass. That's the difference between old school New York. I'm a Rican. I get two black dudes come up on me and say, "Yo, motherfucker, give me your shit." I'm going to be like, "I only have 50. Two 20s and a 10.
Shut the fuck up. There was not two black dude. It was one guy that just pulled it with his finger from my hand.
I understand.
It was very close to my building. And I, you know, he was a Rican, probably.
Yes.
Or Dominican, but they look the
same. He's Latino. Yes.
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 And
but that's the difference. Back in the old days, in the old New York, you would have known how to handle the situation. This is what I'm saying. You would have known to let it go.
Listen, don't tell me how to... It's not old New York or new New York.
No.
You don't think so?
No.
You don't think so?
No,
Tamara, you don't think so?
No, I think that, I mean...
Williamsburg.
Things happen when no one's around to see them. So if you're... And when you're distracted, things are more likely to happen. I mean, I don't know. I just have a feeling like... I think to not think like that anywhere is kind of outdated. You could be in
like
a
what?
Mall parking lot and somebody could come shoot it up these days.
To not think like... Oh, yeah, got
to
it.
To not be about your business and
But
aware.
That's how we've become.
But an instinct, you're going to react to where you react. You often... Adrenaline is pumping again.
That's
so
how we've become. I go to the mall now. I go to the mall and I'm looking really quick. I go on my smartphone and I see which store is having a sale. And I go,
time,
I'm going in there. I'm coming out.
Listen. I ride my bicycle all night long. In LA.
That's different.
I'm a smart ass.
Yes. That's different. A lot of people ride their bikes in LA.
Sometimes I'm fearless.
Mm-hmm. Well, not sometimes.
And I do things that everybody say I'm crazy. Okay.
Well, that's let me correct you. Not sometimes you're fearless. If you've been listening, you've been fearless all your fucking life.
I failed that time.
That time.
Okay.
Well, do me a favor.
And the guy,
please.
We called the guy.
Yeah, of course you caught him.
And I hit it up, you know.
Can I tell you something?
In the back of a cruiser going down like, woo, 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 you know. And it was completely, you know, out of, you know.
I'm going to say something. Don't do that again, please. Just don't do it.
Sometimes we do stupid things. And
I know.
I got a great story out of it.
You did.
The phones make us.
The phones.
The phones, you know.
Make us stupid. I think that's one of the biggest problems in New York City that people don't look at each other. You walk. I mean, you want to talk about issues in New York, that's everywhere, but in a city where, I mean, the wonderful thing about New York over everywhere else in America is that there are no windows separating each other, right?
You're forced to contact each other.
But now we're separated by screens because you rarely can have an interaction with people. And that's what maybe, but that's our culture. That's not, New York City is no different than anywhere else. We can notice it because it's so fast.
New York, you notice it fast is what you're saying is because you're really walking by each other. You're actually touching each other and you're in each other's physical presence all the time. Yeah. Whereas in LA, you're in the train.
On the train, everyone's looking at their screen.
Thank God, not everybody. But there are a lot of days.
Yeah.
But riding a bicycle, it's very scary because people just step in the middle of the block.
Yes.
And
in New York.
Yes.
Everywhere, here too?
Everywhere.
Not here because they're really careful.
They're too busy driving while they're texting.
No. The pedestrian here really are careful crossing.
So check it. We're going to have to wrap it up really quick because we run out of time. But you're going back to New York, Florent,
in a month.
On the 5th.
Well,
I'd like to have you back again because we really didn't get into the crux of all that stuff.
Yeah, we were going to fight. More, we're I gonna, felt.
No, we'll fight. We'll fight more.
Hoping.
No, we'll fight more
I
in
was
the car.
You were gonna tell.
No. Listen. Seriously, all jokes aside,
you need to put an iPhone up. Then he'll put up his Dukes.
No, can I tell you something? You're both very interesting people. I mean, Tamara, you're extremely interesting. I don't know you that well. I just got to know you a little bit. I know your husband. You guys are officially bam married. Well, I know your significant other. I should say Lee Quiñones. I've interviewed him for one of my podcasts. He's a really amazing
and a big fan of the show.
He's a big fan.
Yes,
I love Lee Quiñones.
Yes.
Lee Quiñones is probably one of the most amazing artists that I know. Not just because he's been a prolific graffiti artist, whatever the fuck that means.
But he's also
a challenging artist. That guy, of all the people that I know of that genre, he's the only dude that will go into uncharted territory as an artist.
Yes, he never looks back.
That's amazing to me.
He's famous for the graffiti. He just keeps evolving.
And
he refuses to go back.
And he'll take something like a technique that he's never done before. And you'll be like, I want to do, but not just a study. I want to fucking create this monster. That Lee is unbelievable to me for that reason. But you're fascinating because of where you come from and your car that you drove yesterday. That Mercedes Benz. Fuck that, man. That's unbelievable. big up to that car, Florent. I'm gonna have you back on the show because we didn't argue enough.
Yes.
Rosemary Rodriguez. You just picture locked. Silver Skies, the movie that we produced and the movie that's coming out.
Yes.
So that's a big deal. You're on to sound production, sound design, and all that other stuff. Anyway, listen, we run out of time. Big up. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out on Facebook, Nestorius Public Radio. Check us out on iTunes if you're not already subscribed. Please do so. Tell everybody about it. Nestorius Public Radio. Subscribe. Do your shit. You know what I'm saying? Keep that shit live. Keep it on lock. You know what I mean? Tell your sister. Tell your grandma. You know what I mean? Make it happen.
Talking shit, so y'all gotta encourage me the whole way along. Ow.